You're listening to the Arts in Isolation podcast, brought to you by Asia House.
Hello everybody, I'm Juan de Lara, Culture Program Manager at Asia House, and you're listening to Arts in Isolation, our cultural initiative in partnership with the Barca Trust, which also counts with the support of the Al-Tajir Trust and the Al-Han Trust for Culture. As you know, every week we review elements of our Converging Paths series, and we discuss different topics that deal with the Islamic world, as broad as it can get. And today, I have here with me Michael Backman. Michael was trained as an economist and has actively engaged in the political scene of Australia. He has been a prolific columnist and has authored several books, particularly on trade with Asia, and is the author of the best-selling book, Asian Eclipse. Michael is an expert in politics and economics. He has worked extensively in Asia, and particularly in Southeast Asia. And his most recently published book is a biography of the former Malaysian finance minister Daim Zainuddin. Michael balances his writing career with a prominent Asian art gallery in central London and is also founder of the World Art Now portal. He's now writing the first major published book on Malay silver and gold in the last 100 years. Welcome, Michael. It is a pleasure having you here today, and we will devote this episode to talk about the Malay world, a really important piece of the puzzle of economic history and trade, and also a relevant piece in the Islamic world, which is often forgotten. I think with such a fascinating career, our listeners would like to know, how did you get involved with these cultures?
Well, one, I grew up in a country town in Australia, in South Australia. And I'd almost never met anyone from Asia as I was growing up. It was only when I went to university that I came across people from Malaysia, actually. And right away, I was absolutely fascinated by them. And the other thing that really intrigued me was that they were young like me, and yet they'd come all this way from Malaysia for their education. And I was immediately drawn, you know, I was at university to learn. And one of the most amazing things to learn about was a whole new group of people. And I loved it. I just loved it. So I think, you know, when you're 17 or 18, everything's very new and very formative. And I think my interest in Asia and Malaysia and the Malay people and started then. And it's developed. I mean, it's something that has always stayed with me. I've had all sorts of jobs and worked in politics, and as you mentioned, but I've always been interested in Malaysia. And of course, growing up in Australia, the neighbourhood is Southeast Asia. You know, Australia hangs off the end of the Indonesian and the Malay archipelago, and our nearest neighbours is simply the world's largest Islamic country. And a lot of people don't realise that. So, you know, it wasn't for me to get immediately interested in going off to, you know, on some my gap year or whatever, off to London or, you know, to work in pubs and stuff. No, not for me. The first country I ever visited when I could was actually Singapore and then Malaysia. Subsequently, I worked in Jakarta for a while, and I travelled extensively across the region. And I've written a lot of books, as you alluded to. They've always had a strong focus on Southeast Asia, on the culture and the politics and the business and personalities in Asia. And in fact, my most recently published book was on Daim Zainuddin, a former Malaysian finance minister, and I was very fascinated in him. I was very fortunate because he was a friend of a friend, and that gave me the access. Often accessing some of these people in Southeast Asia, as I'm sure you know, can be very difficult. He fascinated me, and I proposed a book, and he agreed, and I was able to travel with him and to visit him often at his house. Through him, I was introduced to Dr. Mahathir, the former Malaysian Prime Minister, and went to his house, got to know him. And so I was in such a privileged position to get to know these people.
So you clearly take a historical approach to art and contextualize it in the broader discussion of economy and trade. So I'm very interested to hear which were the basis for Daim's reforms and what did it inform you about the people?
That's right. I trained as an economist, and so that's always been the immediate attraction to a lot of this. I look at things, and of course now, as we mentioned before, I have a gallery in London dealing in art, and I come to that from the perspective of an economist being interested in trade and business. And we must always remember when it comes to art that why did anyone do art? They did it to make money. That's always the reason why anyone does art. And we must always remember the business incentive when it comes to art. And that's something that art historians in their silos often forget. But anyway, back to Daim and what that informed me about Malaysia. Well, first of all, the previous books that I'd written, you mentioned Asian Eclipse, looked at a lot of the negatives, a lot of the traps for perhaps Western people doing business in Asia. You know, things like cronyism and corruption. And why I was interested in Daim was because he was an immensely rich man and he was a politician. And as we all know, that normally is bad news. When it comes to Asia, often people go into politics to get rich. But Daim was different. He was different because he was rich already. He went into politics almost reluctantly. Mahathir asked him to go in, and solve problems and kick heads. And that's why he was brought in. There were a lot of economic problems that Malaysia faced. They were too dependent on one commodity, which was tin. And world tin price crashed. The economy needed to be bailed out and they needed a lot of restructuring. And Daim very coolly went in and did it. He was very professional. He relied on a civil service, which actually in Malaysia is actually pretty good, quite professional. And he brought in good people to do things, surrounded himself with good advisors. And another thing that he did was to attempt to redress the race money balance, if you will, in Malaysia. Malaysia today is about 60% ethnically Malay, about 30% Malaysian Chinese and 10% Malaysian Indian. The problem for Malaysia was that the Chinese had become very dominant in the economy, and that's not good when you're trying to build a cohesive country when race is so aligned with commercial power and money. It's a recipe for almost a disaster and ultimately a pogrom, if you like. So, and Daim and Mahathir knew this, and they thought, we've got to redress this. And of course, Malaysian Chinese friends of mine at the time said, we hated it, what they did, because they skewed everything in favor of Malay businesses and were giving Malay people contracts and without, you know, fair tenders. But they've said, actually, we now get it. We get what they've done, because what they did do was to break the nexus, the link between race and wealth. So you can no longer see a Chinese in Malaysia and assume, oh, that's a rich person, and see a Malay person think, oh, there's a poor person. It doesn't work like that anymore. And that has unified Malaysia and made Malaysia a cohesive country that it is today. It's a country, actually, that can face problems. And that's always a test of a country. When you have a problem, does it fall apart immediately? Well, no, not Malaysia. And so that is the success of Daim and Mahathir.
So how do you relate the reforms of Daim to the history of the Malay world?
So how did the Malays back then, who were so prominent in business and trade, how did they go from that to the point where they were requiring, you know, economic preferment policies in Malaysia in the 21st or 20th and 21st centuries? Well, the answer is because most of the trade that was happening in the 17th and 18th centuries was in Malay hands, but it was the Malay sultans who were doing it. Now, what's quite interesting and quite unique, probably, in terms of the world at this period, was that the sultans did not allow a Malay business class or even a middle class to develop. They monopolized trade. They monopolized trade in rice and elephants. I mean, they were even sending elephants to India from the Malay Peninsula at one point. I think the Sultan of Kedah was doing that. So they monopolized trade in all sorts of things, but they wouldn't dirty themselves, the sultans, by actually signing contracts and things like that and negotiating. They left that to, they would have a Muslim Indian at court who would run their business interests for them, almost like the European concept of a court Jew. And this is what European kings and queens would do in around the same time. They'd have a Jewish business person to look after their interests, because being Jewish, they were never going to become a threat to the throne. And so that's exactly what they were doing in the Malay world as well. They'd have an Indian in who wouldn't usurp them because of his ethnicity. So they basically kept all of the business for themselves. Malay people more generally were allowed to trade in a very petty way in their own bazaars, but they weren't allowed to be involved heavily in international trade. So by the time you get to the 19th century, when the Malay world, which is partly in Sumatra mostly, and the rest of it is in the Malay Peninsula, becomes dominated by the Dutch and the British colonialists, the Malays were in quite a weakened state to compete. And then, of course, the Dutch and particularly the British brought in Chinese from China to work the tin mines and to operate shops and all this. And that squeezed out ordinary Malays again. So they again didn't have a chance to develop their skills as business people. So by the 20th century, when Malaysia became independent, the Malays required economic preferment policies to assist them. Now, in terms of the history, what's interesting is that, we've been discussing the Malay preferment policies of Mahathir and Daim under the rubric of the new economic policies, as it was called in Malaysia, to rebalance the wealth equation in Malaysia. And yet, when you look back, say, to the 17th and 18th centuries, the Malays were really prominent. They were well-known traders across the region. And in around 1725, a Dutch writer and traveller by the name of François Valentin, he actually said, "A person," and I quote, "a person who can speak Malay can be understood from Persia to the Philippines." So across this wide area, Malay had become the lingua franca of traders. And this is just phenomenal when you compare it to what's happened, the current experience. And then Malacca, which was a very important little city-state sultanate on the west coast of the Malay Peninsula, it was like a regional collection point where they were brought there, and it was like a bazaar for Southeast Asia where you could go and buy all sorts of products, and then from there they were exported to the rest of the world and grew to such prominence that by the 16th century, the Portuguese traveller Tomé Pires wrote that whoever, this is very dramatic, whoever is lord of Malacca has his hands on the throat of Venice. So that's how important that the Europeans then regarded the Sultanate of Malacca in the 16th century. It was so important that, in fact, in 1511, the Portuguese sailed to Malacca and attacked it and took it for themselves, and it became run as a Portuguese colony from that point on. That was quite disruptive for the Malay world and for trade. And you did actually then have a lot of Malay refugees who fled from Malacca and settled in other parts of the Malay world, such as Patani in southern Thailand, or over in Makassar, in fact, in eastern Indonesia, in Sulawesi. And so this caused like a further diaspora of the Malay world, which again, as we know with sort of dispersed or diasporas, particularly when they're a cohesive ethnic minority, it's very good for promoting trade and cultural exchange and so on.
Certainly, it's fascinating when you start noticing this phenomenon in which traveling and moving craftsmen defines so much of the culture of a group. And I think we have been referring through this podcast so much to the Malay world. And I think we really need to ask you, what is the Malay world? How would you define it?
Yeah, well, of course, most people, when they hear the term Malay, they think of Malaysia. But it's a bit more than that. The Malay world encompasses a lot of the population, the indigenous population of Malaysia, plus the people of southern Thailand who are ethnically Malay, many of the people of coastal Borneo, which is the large island near the Malay Peninsula, and also quite a large number of the people living in the coastal areas of Sumatra in Indonesia. So these people are can be classified as Malay. Altogether around the world, there's about 25 or 28 million Malay people. But what's really important and really interesting from my point of view is that in the past, they were one of the world's greatest trading minorities, and they utterly controlled trade in Southeast Asia, and they were a lot more prominent than that as well. Their influence was right up to across India and to the Middle East and up to China, across the Chinese Sea. So
Malaysia today is not nearly as prominent as many people in Malaysia think it is, unfortunately. It suffers a bit from being a recently created country. It was a product of colonialism. And the Malay diaspora across Southeast Asia was certainly much more prominent in the 17th century than it certainly is now. It also suffers from the fact that it's near a massive neighbour, which is Indonesia. Indonesia has an ethnic Malay population, but most people in Indonesia are not themselves ethnically Malay. The other thing that's really important to understand is that this part of the world contains some of the world's greatest and biggest Islamic populations. Of course, the Malays themselves are Muslims. Indonesia is the world's largest Islamic country. It has around 270 million people. So by a long shot, it's the world's biggest Islamic country. And most people don't remember that. We think about Islam and we often think about the Middle East, but of course that's the minority of Muslims. And today, and this has long been the case for well over a century, that there is a quota system whereby people can go on the Hajj to Mecca, and the number of people coming from Indonesia is the biggest out of all Islamic populations. So I think for Indonesia at the moment, that the quota is about 220,000 people a year. But if you consider, say, Kuwait, they only get a quota of, say, 8,000 people. Or Qatar, if they can even get in these days, it's about 1,200. Even China has more people than Kuwait allowed to go on the Hajj at about 12,000 people. So, and you just think about the number of people who are traveling because of the Hajj, say from Southeast Asia to go to Mecca and the other sites, the other important religious sites of in Saudi Arabia on that peninsula. And this has been going on for such a long time. Now, of course, they can fly. In the past, they'd have to go by ship, and they'd have to go, assemble in Singapore or Aceh in the northern tip of Sumatra. Then they'd go across to India and then up from there to the Gulf and so on. And this was an incredible journey, and it involved traveling over land on the way. And it was an incredible mechanism for exchange and trade and commerce. So it's still the case today, and it has been the case for hundreds of years, that Southeast Asia has been just so connected to the Middle East and to the rest of the Umrah, the rest of the world's Islamic population. But this is not just a religious phenomenon. This is an important trade phenomenon and a transmission mechanism for culture and artistic influence.
So I guess this is the right moment to talk a little bit more about the art of Malaysia and the Malay world. And could you tell us a little bit more about it, about how does it look? What is characteristic of it?
Yes, let's talk about art now. That's something I love. So what is Malaysian art? Well, yes, I mean, is there a Malay aesthetic that we can sort of put almost like a ring fence around and say that is Malay art and this isn't? It's a very good question, because this is something I've had to really grapple with in the time that I've been writing this book. And it's complicated, because the Malays were traders, as we've been talking about. And with trade comes influence and also migration. And the Malay Peninsula itself has been the subject of waves of migrants and so on, not just the Chinese brought in by the British and the Indians, but also Hadrami people from Yemen. And one reason why a lot of Hadramis were attracted to Southeast Asia particularly was because they were of the same religious sort of creed as the Malays. They were Sunnis from the Shafi school, which is very similar to, say, the people of the Indians or the Muslim Indians in South India, for example, and along the Swahili coast. So this has informed Malay art. So, and in fact, it actually goes the other way as well. You can come across Yemen jewellery, which actually has very clear Malay influence. And in the book, I'll be showing one or two examples of this. So, and then, of course, we've got the Malay world is perched in the middle of Southeast Asia, where you've got the Thais to the north and the Indonesians to the southeast and so on. And there's been endless waves of migration and trade and mixing. And you've got the Bugis people from Sulawesi who migrated to parts of the Malay world.
and they had their own aesthetic, and they intermarried with the Malays, and there's been some blending there, and so on. So I think the best way to think about what is Malay art is to think of it as a series of concentric circles where you have sort of like an inner heart, which is clearly Malay, and then you go out and out and out, and it gets less and less orthodox, if you like, and more influenced by outside influences. But the first thing to really know about Malay art, and particularly Malay silver and gold, and the motifs that are used, is that it's Islamic. So therefore, representations of living things and even some physical things are not represented or shown in Malay silver and gold ware. You do have an interesting contrast between sort of broad fields of silver that hasn't been worked, surrounded by very busy vegetative motifs and floral motifs. And all of this is, in some respects, it's a celebration of life and the fecundity of the jungle and so on, and light in a way. So it's almost as if it's like a representation of God, or at least the Malay understanding of God. Vegetation comes from light, and as we know, nor all light, it's a very important concept. That's one of the unifying themes of the inner core of Malay art, is this sort of use of vegetative and scrolling motives, and for me, I just find it absolutely beautiful. It's stunning.
We have been previously discussing your new upcoming publication. You're working on a book about silverware and gold, and I wanted to ask you, why did you decide to focus on silver, particularly?
Well, I'm spending the lockdown period, it's very fortuitous in some respects, because I've been obliged to write this book for quite some time with my publisher, and it's slightly overdue. So this period has got to the point where there are no more excuses now. I must actually sort of settle down and write this. And so it's been marvelous, because it's given me more thinking time and breathing space to really think about the issues of the Malay world art and gold and silver. So silver tells us the story of art, it tells us the story of trade, it tells us the story of migration and craftsmen and world commerce and world expansion. A lot of the silver that the Malays were using, of course, had its original source in the mines of South America and Central America. And so I love silver for that reason. It's terribly romantic and evocative of the last, say, 300 or 400 or 500 years of world economic history. The last serious book that was written on this was published in 1910, so I thought it was time for an update. And not only that, but when I actually have looked at that book, this is a quite a well-known book on Malay silver. It's very good. There are a lot of photographs and whatever, but it really reflects what was available to collectors at that time. And what I'm finding is that with collections of, say, Indonesian and Malay gold and silver that have been developed, particularly quite recently, there's a real bias in terms of what's available now to buy, as opposed to this is not the sum total of say Malay gold and silver, if that makes sense. So the collections often are distorted according to when they were put together. So we still don't have a good overview of actually what has been produced throughout the last 200 or 300 years. Even museum collections are quite distorted. Now, Singapore, their very excellent and wonderful Asian Civilizations Museum, has quite a lot of Malay silver, but it was all collected around 1910. And again, it's a snapshot, not of everything, the totality of what's been produced in the Malay world. It's a snapshot of what they could access around 1910, when British colonial administrators decided, let's pull together enough for a colonial museum. And it's the same here with what the V&A has in the British Museum. What I'm finding is, because the Malay world has gone through a series of restructurings because of colonialization, and what has been available when it comes to Malay silver and gold has changed over time and distorted by world events and so on. And ironically, one of the best places to find Malay silver is not in Malaysia today, but actually in Britain, because the British, as the colonizers of Malaysia, and also briefly for Sumatra in the early 19th century, they at that point were bringing items back to Britain. And of course, now in the art market, it's been churned around, and the identity and the provenance of a lot of these pieces has become lost. And so what I'm finding now, and what I'm basing my research on, is what we can access here, which I can identify as being Malay, but in fact, often these days is thought of as being Indian. So it's an interesting thing of trying to piece together with circumstantial evidence and motives and as to what possibly might be Malay silver, but which has been hiding because it's been misrecognized in the past, misdescribed. So that's what the book is. It's piecing together what we can find and then giving it the right label for probably the first time in several hundred years.
So, Michael, I think it's great to remember that you have done a huge contribution towards furthering our knowledge and retrieving the attribution of certain pieces of huge cultural relevance. And I wanted to ask you about your publication and what do you think is the main aim and what the broader audience will be able to learn from it?
One of the central aims of the book is to restore Malay silver and gold and Malay artwork more to center stage, to where I think it should be. Because I think in the last 100 years and so, with the impact of colonialization and the relative displacement, if you like, of Malay commercial power and political power and so on, particularly in Sumatra, is that we've kind of lost knowledge of what is Malay. I mentioned before that often Malay items have been miscatalogued, even in museum collections, and that's very unfortunate. But also, when the Dutch arrived in Sumatra, for example, they had their own client group that they sort of nurtured, and these were the Minangkabau people, who are not Malay. They're a matrilineal group of central southern Sumatra, and they were terribly interesting. That they've got a very interesting architecture, and even in the late 19th century, the Dutch were pushing people up there for Dutch tourists were encouraged to visit certain Minangkabau villages, and the Minang leaders had become very compliant with the Dutch colonial forces and were helping subduing the rest of Sumatra. And also, coffee plantations were put in Minangkabau areas. And all of this helped to build up the wealth of the Minangkabau people, and that they had this new prominence that they hitherto hadn't had. And that had tended to displace the Malays. And what it also meant was that Minangkabau jewellery and silver and gold became more prominent and more accessible and more accessed by Dutch and other collectors. So now the Minangkabau aesthetic has become overly prominent in collections of Indonesian and Malay art and so on, and Southeast Asian art. And art of the Malay world has not been given the prominence that it really deserves. So what I'm trying to do with this book is to rebalance this, to pull it back towards the Malays, because they were, after all, the most important commercially successful group in Southeast Asia for a long period, right up until, say, the early 19th century.
Well, thank you, Michael, for bringing the Malay world back into the radar. It is fascinating to learn all these things that you so well tie in together and connect in such a lively manner. The Malay world, I think, sometimes has been forgotten, and particularly its broader dialogue of Muslim communities. And without a doubt, we are in front of one of the big participants in the history of the world, and as you very kindly pointed, to the history of business, trade and economy. Since our last podcast have been mostly covering the Mediterranean, I think you have been a wonderful guide, taking us out of the Arab world and taking us to the larger communities of Asia. I wish you good luck with your book. We look forward to it with excitement. I certainly will keep my eyes on it. And I hope that we can welcome you at Asia House as soon as we are able to open our doors to the public.
Oh, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Michael, again, and I'm sure that also the audience. I want to thank all the listeners to our podcast that every week go into asiahousearts.org and listen to it. And please do share it. Subscribe to our newsletter if you haven't done so, because we are sharing all the cultural content as well. And just to say that I very much look forward to seeing you all at Asia House as soon as we are able to open our doors to the public. And until then, I wish you a beautiful week. Take care and stay safe.
You were listening to the Arts in Isolation podcast, brought to you by Asia House. For more information, please visit our website, asiahousearts.org.